When you see how many crises we have in the world, you know, not only ISIS, but Ukraine and also North Korea, what is your general analysis? Why do we have so many crises? What would be your main thought? Why we have so many crises at the same time? We hardly can remember. And the second, what are the most important actions we have to follow?
Yes, that's a great way to start. So we have to put things in relative context. In a situation where we have crises in Libya, in Ukraine and Russia, in the Straits of Hormuz, the crisis in Syria, the collapse of Syria, really, tensions in the South China Sea, this is not unprecedented, first of all. The 1980s was an incredibly turbulent, violent decade. You had just had the Iranian revolution. You had just had the hostage taking at the Grand Mosque in Saudi Arabia. You had the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Terrorism was rife, the Iran-Iraq war, and so on and so on. So we need to be, you know, we always amplify the present because we live in it. And we also tend to forget the past. But the truth is that today's volatilities remind me quite a bit of the 1980s. Secondly, the number of international conflicts has fallen to nearly zero. Of course, we live in a world of tremendous violence, of disturbances, of tensions, of escalations, of standoffs, and of terrorism, and all sorts of humanitarian tragedies. That is all true. However, it is also true that the number of significant cross-border international military conflicts has fallen to effectively zero. Even Ukraine and Russia is now something of what you would call perhaps a stalemate. I don't diminish its importance by any stretch of the imagination. It's a very significant borderline and area of tension today. But it is not representative of the entire world. If we look at the entire world, what we see is that the dominant pattern, if you will, is much more infrastructural integration across borders than it is conflict over borders. And for every time we have a tension over a border region, or for every time we have a risk such as the Schengen Agreement being repealed and so-called borders going back up, by and large, both statistically and empirically around the world, we see far more openness than we see closure. So let me give you an obvious example. The European Union, even if borders were to actually go back up, which is not really the case, only partially, but even if the population of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, where I now live in Singapore, which is effectively the capital, if you will, of this ASEAN region, has 750 million people. The population of the region that I am in is larger than the population of the region that you are in. And in this region, these 750 million people have just passed a ASEAN economic community in which there is total free mobility of people and of labor, right? So more people, more of the time, most of the time, all of the time, are experiencing more mobility, more connectivity, more freedom, and more security and more opportunity than ever before. And I think what we have to be very careful of is either the Donald Trump kind of threat or the threat from European left-wing or right-wing populism. These are not representative of the world. And of course, since you are a very global thinker, you have the World Security Network, you surely want to take into account a balanced view of all of the world's perspectives and activities at the same time. And if we do that, we come to very different conclusions about what's happening.
The concept of security, which you mentioned, what is basically the main, what are the main theses in your book? For statesmen, for leaders in parties, and for young politicians, to save the world, so to say.
So young people, when I was a student in Europe in the 1990s, I sensed that European integration was something almost of an inevitable trend. You know, young people were pro-European. They went to Euro 2020 conferences. And now I see that as they've gotten older, they have obviously become much more cynical about globalization, about the European sort of project, and so forth. And that, of course, is very disappointing because I always thought about European integration and European globalism as a linear sort of process of evolution. What I would tell young people, especially in Europe today, is not to give up on the integration project. They obviously are too young to have remembered the suffering that their parents and grandparents' generation went through to build this Europe. But they would be quite simply fools or foolish to believe that retrenchment towards smaller political and economic units would lead to greater prosperity and stability. That is a mythology peddled by very ignorant and dangerous ideologies of certain politicians. In the real world, and in the empirical world, in the academic world, we know from hundreds and hundreds of years of history and plenty of research that the most successful, most stable, most peaceful, most prosperous societies in the world are also those that are the most open and the most connected and the most integrated with their neighbors and beyond. So nothing that any politician can say can undermine that historical fact. And I think that we should be very, very clear. And I wish that European politicians had the bravery to point out these historical and contemporary realities. But of course, you don't seem to score political points by speaking the truth these days in either American or in European politics.
So you would argue, some say globalization is dead, nationalism is on the rise. You would argue against it from your perspective.
Well, globalization is far from dead. Globalization is entering a new golden age. I know that it is fashionable in certain circles, such as on television programs or even major publications like The Economist, to argue that there is strong headwinds against globalization because of slowing growth in China, because of falling commodities prices, because of capital pulling back from emerging markets because of higher interest rates in the U.S. There are many data points that people give, but quite frankly, they're completely wrong. We've never had higher volumes of net international capital flows. We may have had a pullback of certain flows of capital from emerging markets in precisely the last 18 months, but we have not had a, that does not mean that the total volume of capital flows has fallen. The total volume of capital flows remains at record levels. Also, we should not think only about a trade in goods. Very often the people who are making these arguments about globalization slowing down are referring to a deceleration of growth in manufacturing, trade, and exchange. But the fact is that that's not the correct way to measure the total volume of trade. We don't even have good data for the volume of services, and the value of services trade in the world economy is far larger than the value of goods trade in the world economy. So it is as if these economists are all automobile manufacturers in Detroit, suddenly giving you a picture of the world that reflects less than 5% of the labor force. So I find this disingenuous. I find it faulty. I find it outdated and matter-of-factly incorrect. And of course, whether you're looking at migration, whether you're looking at capital flows, whether you're looking at technology, whether you're looking at ideas, whether you're looking at social media, if you're looking at travelers, tourists, business travelers, by every conceivable metric that you could possibly imagine and make a concrete list of, globalization is expanding. In no conceivable measure that you could possibly list on a piece of paper is globalization receding. And what's even more important than that is that the capacity for global interaction is growing every minute because we're building more roads, more railways, more pipelines, more electricity grids, more internet cables, more data centers, more satellites. All of those things that facilitate connectivity are growing, and they're literally growing by the minute with the trillions of dollars of investment that we are making, with the billions of people that are moving to cities and urbanizing and switching on their mobile phones and getting onto the internet. So again, it would be a very, very narrow view, a view rooted in precisely the last 8 months, the last 18 months of a slowing economy, rather than reflecting the thousand-year story and reality of increasing globalization and integration.
Barak, that's excellent. I think thank you so much. I think that is, for our readers, for our audience, a very good summary.